I'm having a difficult time following a particular vow or being determined. It's often because they're doing things that don't give them the realization they need to follow that vow. Does that make sense? It's actually very simple. Do you know that practically, if you look at your life, you'll see that everything you do produces some kind of realization. It has some kind of effect. It's interesting meditation, isn't it? That everything you do will produce some kind of realization, some kind of effect on you. So we're going to talk about that. That's really the essence of what we're going to speak about here. How everything we do is going to affect us. And how you can see in your own life, if you're having difficulty following a vow, keeping a commitment, it's likely that you're doing things that are not supporting it. You're acting in a way which is contrary to supporting what you want to achieve. Even though you may, in a very narrow way, be focusing on that particular vow or that goal, but in a broad or a global way, the things you do throughout your day may all not be supportive of it. Just like a lot of the self-help gurus, they say, if you have a goal, then you should write the goal down, and then you should look at your life and see how what you're doing every day is moving you closer to that goal. Because it's going to move you closer to it, or it's going to keep you where you're at, or it may move you away from it. So if you make a vow, then you want to look at your life and see, well, what am I doing that's helping support this vow, that's making it easier, or giving me more strength or determination to follow it? So that's the idea. And what am I doing that's giving me the realization I need to be able to do this? Just like many, many of us lived in temples. And to live in a temple, we had to take a vow of celibacy. So if you've taken a vow of celibacy, you know how difficult that is. And if you haven't, you could imagine how difficult that is. So, but at the same time, it's not difficult if you're supported by realizations in Krishna consciousness, because the proper realization will support the proper dealings with the opposite sex, which will enable you to practice celibacy and keep your heart and mind pure. So it's difficult. It's especially difficult if you're not engaged in supportive activity. Just like there's a story of a Jamil that's in the Bhagavatam, sixth canto. Now Jamil, he was born in a Brahmin family, so it was a devoted family. And so if you're born in a Brahmin family in ancient times in India, it's kind of like what you could consider aristocracy. Like if you're born in a very wealthy family, you're not just going to go to any school. You're going to go to private schools. And you're going to go to the best private schools, and you'll have personal tutors. And if you're going to, let's say, learn to play the piano, your parents will probably buy you one of the best grand pianos made, and they'll find one of the best teachers in that city to teach you. It's like that. So a Brahmin's life is a little bit like that, spiritually speaking. It's refined. It's a certain, you know, certain things that Brahmins would just never do. They never eat meat. They never take drugs or alcohol. They're very pure. That's the life of a Brahmin. So the Jamil was raised as a Brahmin. And one day he was out and about, and he saw this couple embracing. I don't know, they were probably like half naked or whatever. He was a young boy and he had never seen this, and they were, you know, very, very sensual. And he saw that, and it made this intense impression on him. And it affected his whole consciousness. And then it planted the seed in his heart of a desire to do that. So Prabhupada points out in that purport that if one wants to live a life of purity, it's extremely difficult because it's possible he's going to see all the things around him that he has given up. He's going to see the things being done that he's given up. So he said one has to be extremely pure in how he lives and how he thinks and what he eats and so forth to support that vow of celibacy. And I think you can understand, because it's so difficult, you can imagine, you know. If someone wants to practice celibacy, I don't recommend watching movies that have sexual scenes. I don't recommend watching movies in general or television. But practically speaking, if you turn on the television, that's what you're going to see sooner or later if you're not careful. So, you understand the idea. You don't want to subject yourself to things which would undermine the vows you make. So, To follow one's vows, one must perform many supportive activities, activities which give one the realization and strength to continue following those vows. So it's not that we only focus on the vow, but we focus on all the activities we need to do or avoid that will strengthen our vow. In other words, lifestyle must support our determination to follow the vows we make. Which is really interesting, because I think a lot of people, when they make a vow, they don't understand they have to have a concomitant lifestyle to support it. And they think, okay, I'm just going to do this, but they don't understand the ramifications of it. So when you make a vow, I suggest you meditate on the ramifications of following that vow, what it means. If I'm going to do this, what would that mean in my lifestyle? And am I prepared to make those changes that will support that vow? You know, a lot of times people get married and what happens after 6 months or a year, they did not realize what it was going to be like. Or after they have a kid or two or three, you know, they'll look back and they'll think, I didn't realize it was going to be this way. I don't know how prepared I am for this. Or they have to prepare. They have to be prepared for it. But oftentimes people are not prepared for it because they didn't realize the ramifications of the responsibilities and the difficulties. And that can happen also for people who don't get married but become brahmacharis and take a vow of celibacy, or people who take sannyas and don't realize the ramifications of what's involved. They may have seen some things that they could do, but they didn't see all of what would be required. So that's really an important point to consider when you're making a vow. How my life's going to have to change to follow it. And a lot of people make vows and they don't think they're going to have to change their lives, and then they run into trouble. Okay, lifestyle must support our determination to follow the vows we make. In order to do this, it's also important to understand the depth of the vows we are making, because often when making a vow, we might not fully understand the depth or ramifications of those vows. For example, we may assume that a vow means one thing, and the person we made the vow to assumes or expects that it means much more than we think. For example, you may get married and you think, I'm speaking as a man, you think, as a man, this is what I define chastity to my wife, or chastity to the relationship of marriage in a particular way. And it means doing certain things and not doing other things. That may not be at all how my wife assumes that I should act as a proper husband. So the same way, we may make a vow to our spiritual master to follow regulative principles, to chant 16 rounds and so forth. But the quality of the rounds we chant may not be the assumption that he was making when we said we would chant 16 rounds. He was assuming we would chant 16 attentive rounds with feeling. He wasn't assuming we would chant them in our bed, laying on our back while watching television and eating sweet balls. So, you know, that's an important point. We may not understand the depth of the commitment we're making when we make a commitment, because we make assumptions about it without understanding what the assumptions or the needs of the person we're making the vow to are. So that's important. Or we may just be ignorant about what's involved when we commit. We just have no idea. So before we commit, it's important to know the full ramifications of the commitment. For example, here's another example. It's a nice one. If you ever take a leadership role, people under you expect certain things. They expect you to behave a certain way. They expect to be treated a certain way. So a lot of times someone will take a leadership role and people around him will be upset by what he or she is doing. He just can't figure out why. Because when he took the leadership role, there were certain expectations that people had of a leader in that position. So he committed to take a particular role, but he didn't know, or she didn't know, what was involved in terms of what other people expect. I've been in that position before, and I can tell you, it's not easy, because people expect a lot of a leader. And it's especially not easy when you don't know what they expect and you go into that role. And a lot of times, I was just reading something very interesting. Where did it come from? It may have come from Sanatana Goswami, but Sanatana Goswami, and in many other scriptures, it says, when you want to take initiation from a guru, the guru and disciple should study one another for 1 year. And one of the reasons, of course, is for the guru to see if the disciple is qualified, and it's also for the disciple, prospective disciple, to see if the guru is qualified. But another reason, which is very interesting, said so they can see if they're compatible. You know, like we see, you may want to get married and you'll do astrology and say, are we compatible? And there's also some question of compatibility with guru. It's interesting, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever thought of that. Guru-disciple compatibility. Maybe my guru is a grihastha and he's in one place. Maybe my guru is a sannyasi and he's always traveling. And one may be more compatible or less compatible. So the guru, as a leader, has to see if his position as a leader is compatible with the disciple and vice versa, so that when they each make the commitment, that there are no unstated assumptions. Okay. If you find out after you committed, if you find out what is entailed in the commitment after you commit, then it becomes more difficult to follow those commitments. That's why a lot of people who took initiation when they're young, they'll say, what will they say? They can't follow now, so what will they say? Who knows? But they'll say, when they were young and they took initiation, what will they say? Anybody out there? I can't follow now because I was young when I took initiation and I didn't know what I was doing. Of course, they should have been helped to know what they were doing, and they should have thought, what am I doing? But for many of us who were 18, 19, 20 when we took initiation, we couldn't think that way. Just our brains didn't function that way. So I'm trying to help you understand that it's important to know what you're doing, the full ramifications of it. I mean, why is there so much divorce? People don't understand the ramifications. They don't understand the person they're marrying. They don't take time to understand them, to understand themselves, the ramifications and responsibilities of being married, the possible difficulties that they'll undergo, how will they deal with them, so on. So the more you understand, the more equipped you are, or the more equipped you are to make a decision that you may not want to marry this person. Okay. Anyone who has any questions, just ask. Otherwise, I'm going to keep speeding along here. And if I'm a little redundant, it's purposeful, because I just want to make sure you get this, because this can help you a lot in the future, in the present and the future. Now, I want to define what spiritual vows are. I've defined it before. I want to define it again because Archie's asking, is it okay for me to get married at my age? I don't know how old you are. If you're under 18 or over 70, probably not, but give me a... You want to let me know how old you are? Yeah, that depends. It 50. So it depends on your. It depends on your spiritual level of consciousness and what you need and what you don't need. For some people, at that age, they might feel okay. Now it's time to renounce. But if someone feels unfulfilled at that age, then they might see it would be beneficial. The point is, you don't want to die hankering with unfulfilled material desires. But if they can be fulfilled, or not fulfilled, if they can be fulfilled, so to speak, or transcended, or somehow or other engaged in Krishna consciousness, then one will not need to fulfill them. Sometimes Prabhupada said you could take Krishna as your husband and fulfill yourself that way. But that's not easy for everyone. So that's a general answer. But again, you should know what you're getting into. Getting married at 50 is not the same as getting married at 20. Okay, now, we defined spiritual vows before. I'm going to define it again because it's important to go over this definition for the sake of the discussion we're having now. Spiritual vows are defined as an offering to God that we commit to make not only now, but those offerings are committed to the future as well. Just like you may commit to anything. I can see there's going to be a whole discussion about should she get married at 50? Let her decide. or otherwise, we're going to have... this sounds like a hot topic here. But I want to stay on the subject, okay? Can you all follow me here? So, I don't think she wants to have more kids. I don't think it's possible now anyway. But it's just for companionship and support and so forth. I'm sure. So... I'm going to offer something to Krishna. Let's say I'm going to cook something and offer it to Krishna, right? But a vow means I'm going to cook, for example, I'm going to cook something offering to Krishna 100 times in the next 100 days. That would be a vow. I'm going to make an offering, but I offer to do it for a certain period of time. That's a vow. So I think the best way to understand a vow, it's like taking out a loan that you're going to pay a certain amount of money every month. Okay. $100 every month. So I'm committing 4 rounds every day, 16 rounds every day, principles, you know. It's a commitment I've made. Now there's a debt. Of course, Prabhupada said you can never pay back your guru because the debt is too great. But in this sense, there's a debt. When you make a commitment, there's a debt. Okay. All right. So that's the definition we're dealing with. Okay. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the environment by talking about samskaras. Have any of you heard of the word samskara? Does anybody know what it means? I think the Indians, Manjesh, you must have heard of samskara, right? Samskara. Purificatory rites. In India, you have certain purificatory rites, right? At the time of conception, during pregnancy, at the time of birth, name-giving ceremony, first grain-eating ceremony. And then there's the Brahman, you know, Upanayam ceremony. The boy gets Brahman initiation in the Brahman family, like that. And then there's the Vivaha, the marriage. And then there's, at the time of death, there's another samskara. So, samskaras, Prabhupada describes them as reformatory activities, reformatory rites, purificatory rites. We do these things for purification, but what samskara, when we say we do these things for purification, they also create impressions. So in Buddhism, if you look at Buddhism, I don't think they have these same samskaras. They define samskara as mental impressions or mental dispositions that. So how do these things tie together? Well, by performing certain purificatory rites, they create positive impressions which empower or facilitate spiritual practice, spiritual development. That's the idea. So the concept of samskara as mental impression is very interesting because whatever we're seeing is creating a mental impression. Whether we want it to or not, it does. And I'm sure you've all experienced seeing something that affected your heart in a conscious way. We may see things that affect us, but unconsciously we're not aware of it. But you may have seen something that just jolted your consciousness, something good or something bad, and it had a tremendous effect on you. You might have seen, for example, there was a devotee in our movement called Jayananda, and many of you may have heard about him. Jayananda was very humble. And so many of the senior devotees in our movements often talk about Jayananda because the way he acted created such an impression on them that they've never forgotten it. And when the devotees talk about Jayananda, they'll say, I saw him do this or he told me this, and that changed my life. So oftentimes, what you see can change you drastically. I'll give you another story. This is such a wonderful story. This story is told by Mahanidhi Swami. Mahanidhi Swami, he's been living in Vrindavan for the last 18 years. and he is a very wonderful devotee, very Krishna conscious, and he once went to visit a famous guru. I don't know where this guru was. Maybe Vrindavan area, maybe somewhere else. And this guru, he's well known, he has thousands of disciples. So Mahanidhi Swami went to see him, and Mahanidhi Swami is an American, raised in California. And this guru is, you know, great devotee from birth, like that, you know, very pure soul. So when Mahanidhi Swami went to visit him, many, many people in the room, he's a very important person. He got off his seat, he went and got him some water, ordered all his disciples, not all his disciples, ordered some of his disciples to help Mahanidhi Swami, give him what he wanted, gave him a seat. He was personally serving him. And Mahanidhi Swami said he was overwhelmed by that. He was completely overwhelmed by that. And that, and seeing that made this tremendous impression on his heart. And you could imagine, you know. And Mahanidhi Swami was feeling like, who am I? I'm just, you know, 30, 40 years ago, I was a malecha. I wasn't raised in a Brahmin family. I've done so many sinful things. And here is this pure soul, pure from birth. He has so many disciples and so forth. And he's coming off his Vyasa-san. He's going in the kitchen. He's bringing me water. He's making sure I'm comfortable, giving me a seat, ordering his disciples to help him serve me. So what we see creates impressions. What we hear creates impressions. What we do creates impressions. What we touch creates impressions. So why am I talking about this? Samskara, impressions. We keep hearing the same thing, seeing the same thing. These impressions are like samskaras. You can look at it like grooves in your heart, just this impression. And then what happens? Activity follows as a result of the impressions, like a habit. What's a habit? It's this impression which produces behavior, which produces a deeper impression, which produces behavior, and it goes back and forth, and you create a habit, which is good if it's a good habit. It can be an addictive habit, which is degrading you. And so samskara, repeated, what we say is that when you commit an activity, it drops a seed to perform that same activity again. So if you commit a sin, what is dropped is a seed to commit that sin again. And if you commit another activity which counters the sin, it produces the desire to commit to perform that activity again. So that's how samskara works. So in the broadest sense, everything we do is affecting us, our consciousness on some level. So now we go back to vows. I've taken certain vows in my life. You've taken certain vows. We've all taken certain vows. Or at least if we haven't taken official vows, we have some determination or some obligations to show up every day at work, to be a father or mother or husband or wife or son or daughter with some commitment. So we're all committed in some way. Now, what kind of samskaras are we allowing ourselves to be impressed in our consciousness? Are we allowing ourselves to be impressed with samskaras that support what we want to achieve or what we've committed ourselves to achieve? Or are we allowing ourselves to be impressed with samskaras that are undermining? So the important point here is everything is creating impressions. Just like you know, you like oftentimes, you may not be doing well, but you see somebody else doing what you should be doing, and you get inspired by seeing that. So oftentimes, the spiritual master will advise, or it's typically advised by the acharyas, when someone is having difficulty doing something, they say, then associate with a person who's doing what you want to do. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, if you're committing aparad when you're chanting, you're not chanting with the proper mood, proper focus, proper attention, he said, what should you do? You should find someone who's chanting properly and sit with them and chant. And by their association, it will make proper impressions on you, so you'll do the right thing. Does that make sense? So if you find yourself lacking, yeah, the moderator is typing. He's trying to keep you guys focused on what I'm saying. This is very valuable stuff for you. You're getting, if I would have known all this 40 years ago, I would be much better off now. So I had to make all the mistakes to be able to give this to you. So, so we need to be sensitive to the impressions that we allow ourselves to enter. You know, because you can allow poison to come in through your ears, through your eyes, through your mouth, through your sense of touch. Or you can allow nectar to come in, either way. And then we'll be affected by it. So sometimes we'll see a devotee, and the devotee is very inspired, very Krishna conscious, and we think, I would like to be like that. But then you might think, this devotee must be special. He must have been a very advanced devotee in his last life. He must be a rare soul for him to be so Krishna conscious. But then I would say to you, go and live with that devotee, or be around the devotee and see what he does, see how he lives. And you will see that the very things he does are things which inspire one in Krishna consciousness. And I would say, when you find that devotee that you respect, find out what he does and do what he does. Because then, if you want to be like him and you do what he does, it's likely you'll be like him sooner or later. Makes sense, doesn't it? It's not like mystical or magical. You know, often we see devotees and they're very Krishna conscious. And I was thinking, we should write a book, The Success Principles of a Devotee. And you just find successful devotees and interview them and say, what do you do? How do you live? What are your attitudes? How do you think? Just like in the material, in the secular world, they have all the books on success. How do you become successful in anything? They interview people. They find out these were the principles they followed. These were the ways they thought. There's a certain way to think if you want to be successful. There's a certain way that people who are not successful think. So they interview the successful people, and they find out, oh, there's certain commonalities amongst them. That successful people think in this way. They don't think in that way. They act in this way, act in that way. So then I was thinking, okay, we should write a book, The Success Principles of the Pure Devotees. Say, how do they think? How do they act? What don't they do? What do they make sure that they do every day? I just read yesterday the most amazing thing. Should I tell you? Are you all listening, or what's going on out there? Are you listening to me? You want to hear something amazing from this book? Yeah, it would be a great book. Maybe I should write it. That would be a great book, wouldn't it? All you have to do is interview some wonderful devotees, and yeah. Pure Devotee Success Principle. Okay, foot dust. Make sure I write it. Should I take a vow to foot dust to write the book? I don't know. That would be... I'll think about it. Maybe I'll think about it. Because if I take a vow, then I'm going to do it, and I don't want to let you down. So, anyway, what was I saying? I totally lost my train of thought. Talking about successful devotees? Yeah. So, we compile this book, and then we see, okay.
I'm going to tell an amazing story.
Oh, the amazing story. Oh, yes. Here's an amazing story. First, I was two amazing stories. Let's get focused here. Focus is very important. Okay, so this one devotee, before he chants japa, the amazing story. So before he chants japa, he spends 15 minutes offering prayers all the way up the disciplic succession. To his guru, to Srila Prabhupada, to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, Gorkhasordas Babaji, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Jagannath Das Babaji, all the way up, offering prayers, glorifying, and each devotee and praying for mercy. That's an interesting success principle, isn't it? He said, by that he gets mercy so that he can then chant his rounds. Now, you ain't heard nothing yet. Listen to this. There's another devotee whose name I will not mention, and we cannot imitate his activities, but periodically he goes to Govardhan for R&R, which in Krishna conscious terms is not really mundane rest, but it's rest from Maya and recuperation and re-inspiration and re-evaluation and refocus. And what he does, he does the same thing that this devotee does, but he does it for 2 hours. And he goes through not only the disciplic line, he goes through all the gopas and all the gopis in Krishna Lila and all the personalities in Gaur Lila, just begging and praying for their mercy. And then he offers respects to all his god brothers. And he has a special session to offer respect to all the god brothers that don't like him. And that takes him 2 hours. And then he begins to chant his rounds. So if we put that in our book on the success principles of the devotees, we may not be able to follow the 2-hour program, but we get the idea. So this is just an example to show you that if you want, or you want to emulate, you want to be, not emulate, if you want to be like someone who you respect, idolize, just find out what they do and do it. And then you will also be. Yeah, all gopis, gopis, parsha, yeah, every. So it's amazing. Praying for the mercy. Now, if you study Prabhupada's books carefully, he gives you all kinds of hints of little things you can do to be more Krishna conscious. And sometimes we take these things for granted. But the more Krishna conscious we want to be, the more we start to see them. And the point is, the advanced devotees, they pick up on it. Because as anyone who wants to achieve a goal badly enough, they pick up on all the things you need to do to achieve the goal, right? And whereas people who are not really into the goal, then they kind of, you know, they read it, but it doesn't register. So there are many, many things which we can do. And here, these devotees are seeing the benefit of praying to great devotees. Because they know mercy comes through the devotee. And they know that if you meditate on a devotee, then the qualities of that devotee, you start imbibing those qualities. Did you know that? So let's say the vows you've made, you need certain qualities. Now, if you meditate on a particular devotee who has those qualities, you can imbibe those qualities through that meditation. So you're creating a different kind of samskara, right? You create one kind of samskara, you watch a movie and a couple are making love. That's one kind of, and what's that samskara? That samskara is to do the same thing yourself. But if you meditate on someone like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who was a celibate all his life, then what happens? You'll start feeling the desire to practice celibacy. Because you'll be getting, those qualities will gradually shower upon you. So you understand, when you understand samskara, then you understand there's so many things you can do to support yourself. So, let me see if I've missed anything. Okay, I wanted to end with another last thought and then you can ask some questions. If you've been asking questions, I haven't even been concentrating on it because I'm just trying to focus on this. I want to talk about the idea of repeated actions becoming habits. Now, it's said that we have around 60,000 thoughts a day. Who's a good mathematician? How many thoughts an hour is that? If we have 60,000 a day, divided by 24 is what? 2,500 thoughts an hour? Is that right? Somebody out there with a calculator? 60,000 thoughts per day divided by 24 will give us the total of thoughts per hour. My estimation is about 2,500, 26, 27. Manjesh says 25, 25 minutes. I am pretty good, huh? I'm a human calculator in disguise. Okay. Divide that by 60. What do we get? Like, what, 40? Divided by 60 equals 40 thoughts a minute. That makes sense. It's about one thought every second and a half, right? Or something like that. Yeah. Okay, so basically thoughts are constant, right? And the psychologists say of the 60,000 thoughts we have, most of them are the same. Which is really good if the only thoughts you have are Krishna conscious and they keep repeating themselves. That would be wonderful. And it's not a good thing if those thoughts continually repeat themselves, which are thoughts you don't want. So the idea is that samskaras are creating impressions, and then they tend to regenerate the same, because these impressions keep regenerating the same thoughts, which produce, therefore, thereby produce the same actions, which then create the same thoughts again, and it creates this cycle. So if you understand that, and you understand, okay, I have a certain determination, I've made certain vows, so let me perform activities which will support those vows. Right? Do the samskaras that will support it. And then there'll be this continuation of her habitual way of thinking. And you see this in devotees who are advancing in Krishna consciousness. They always want to talk about Krishna. They just always want to do Krishna conscious things. As their thoughts have become preoccupied because of the samskaras they're doing, because of everything they're doing is purifying them, so it's reinforcing the desire to be Krishna conscious. So this, I'm hoping this will be helpful for you in understanding both whether or not you should make a vow, and understanding if you do make a vow, what is actually required, and if you have made a vow, what would be required if you're having difficulty to support it, and even if you're not having difficulty, how you can do certain things, which will create these impressions and the external and environment which will support what you want to do. That's all I have to say. Now, if you have any questions, please ask. Yes, the moderator has a question and I'll repeat it.
Sometimes young people in Krishna consciousness take initiation too early for external reasons, the pressure from the parents, pressure from the other community members. And then later on in life they feel that, you know, I was pushed into this. What recourse do they have? Do they become uninitiated and disinitiated again?
So he's asking, sometimes people take initiation when they're young, and either you're saying in that situation it's peer pressure or pressure from...
Or they may just be themselves idealistic at that
point. Oh, they were idealistic, yeah. Or they were pressured into it. Or another reason is that they just thought they had to. That's, you know, they read the books, and after reading the books, initiation is one of the most important activities in Krishna, so they do it. And after having done it, then they're having trouble. Okay, what should they do? They should, number one, have the aspiration, if they cannot follow now, to get back to following at some point in their life. That's extremely important. Because if they give up that aspiration, then it's downhill from there. So that aspiration should be there. And then they should make a plan according to what they think they can practice and maintain. So that if I can do this now, at least I haven't given up everything. And then build on that, what is gradual and natural. And now, we've discussed in this program Prabhupada's attitude, which was the attitude of not looking for the excuse, but looking for the mentality and attitude that will develop the strength to follow. Because it's much easier to say that, well, I didn't know and I was pressured, and that may be true. But the fact is, you did make it, so the fact that you made it is important, even if you didn't know and even if you were pressured. And then, so how can you deal with that in the best way? And that would be, you know, let's get on track in some way, rather than just saying, well, I was pressured and therefore I'm not going to do it at all. So, what if we, so Manjesh is saying, what if we think frequent thoughts on Krishna but associate, live with non-devotees? Is that wrong? We can really, I don't think we can really change much with that, otherwise tending local temple programs. If we live with non-devotees, is that wrong? That you'll have to decide. I mean, generally, it tends to be problematic, but it depends how non those non-devotees are. Are they Indian Brahmins that you're living with who do puja for 4 hours a day? Or are they are materialists who are engaged in very sinful activities? General principle is, you know, we should associate with devotees and disassociate with non-devotees. Now, at work, that's another thing. But I like to think that I'm a devotee, so in a sense I'm always on stage. You know? Like people are always looking at me. And I've seen a lot of times if I'm acting in a very Krishna conscious way, people will say something about me. They'll say, like, you're really patient, or you're really peaceful, aren't you? Or I really get a good vibration from you. So I feel that kind of like it's our duty, you know? We're always being looked at, and if we act and think like devotees, our relationships with people will be different than the relationships they normally have, and then that will inspire them. And when they find out we practice Krishna consciousness, it kind of creates that relationship that people know this is who you are and what you do. So even if you're with non-devotees, there's that respect for that and understanding of that, that, you know, I don't go to the bar, I don't eat meat, you know. If we're going to go to a restaurant, I don't want to go to, you know, there's got to be a restaurant where I can eat at. And so it creates boundaries for you. So, and have you ever heard this statement, integrity is what you do when no one's looking? So that's also there. It's not that we should think, well, I live with non-devotees or I work with non-devotees, therefore it's okay to do and think and act and be like them. No, we should always be and act and live like devotees. The problem is if we don't get enough association with devotees, we may stop acting like that. So still, you're on stage and everybody's looking at you. And if you act like a devotee, something's going to rub off, even they don't know you're a devotee. I'll give you an example. I had some computer problems, so I was talking to this person, and I said, where are you? And he said, oh, I'm in Calcutta. And I said, Gauranga. And he was in shock. He goes, because I'm in America. He goes, how do you know that? And I go, and I start quoting verses in Bengali, and he's like totally bewildered, and he's putting all his friends in the call center on the phone. He says, could you say that to my friends? And so he wouldn't get, after a half hour, he was asking me questions about Krishna for a half hour. He wouldn't let me off the phone. I was telling him, you need to go to Mayapur, go to ISKCON, get on the bus, go to Mayapur. So anyway, you know, there's so many opportunities to share Krishna consciousness. And then, you know, then we're on stage, we're the devotee. But, you know, so I don't know who your non-devotee friends are, but I mean, you could easily solve your problem by making your non-devotee friends devotees. Then you'll be living with devotees. And making everyone you work with a devotee, then you'll be working with devotees. Right? Not so easy, right? But maybe you can do it. Give it a try, Manjesh. Everyone you meet, tell them about Krishna, make them devotees, give them the holy name. Maybe you'll be associating with devotees all the time now. Yeah. Hiranyakashipu said association is like a crystal ball. You see whatever you look in that and it reflects. Very nice example. Thank you. How can we share Krishna consciousness? That depends. Like I'm saying, one way you share it is by your behavior, just by people seeing how you act. And I I think one good way to share it is to drop, how should I say it? You drop little, what's the word I'm looking for? You say things that spark interest. What's the, what am I, you know, what's the, like appetizers kind of to get them hungry. You say things which arouse conversations. And so they won't think you're trying in any way to talk to them about spirituality or convince them, but you say something. So I had this friend, he was a comedian, and the way he would do it, whenever we were together, especially in an elevator or in a shot at a market in a line, he would talk real loud with his big, thick New York accent, because he's from New York, and he would say, "Oh my God, I read in the paper today that they're putting dead animals in the meat. It's so gross, I can't stand it." You know, and I'd be trying to keep a straight face, and half the time I couldn't. And he'd say it really loud, and it was really funny in an elevator because, you know, people had to hear it, and in a grocery store line, they had to hear it. And then someone invariably would say, but aren't animals dead anyway? And he would go, "Oh my God, I never thought of that. That's so gross. I'm not going to eat meat anymore." But he would really act it out like he was surprised. And people would start going, "Yeah, I never thought of that." So you see, indirectly, you know, I don't know if you all want to do that, if you have the nature to do that, but it was pretty funny. But you understand what I'm saying, you know, there's things that could be said that would bring people into conversations, spiritual conversations, even conversations just about what to eat, what not to eat, what to think, about thoughts, and, you know, about virtues, so many ways. There's dead animals in the meat. Wow. And we said, he said it once, another guy said, "Yeah, I read that too." And then we found out actually they were taking like the toenails and the hair and this and that of other dead animals, and, you know, or the same animals are putting in the meat. Anyway, it was pretty funny. Uh-huh. Anyway, oh yeah, you could put Tilak on, or you could have a t-shirt, you could, you know, you can go to Office Depot and get these patches, and you can print them out and then, you know, wear a t-shirt with a patch on it, or, you know, get a button made, or get a sign in your office on your desk that says something and change the sign every week. And people will ask, "Wow, what's that?" Or have a Bhagavad Gita on your desk just sitting there. "What's that book?" And give books to people, yeah. Give the right book to the right person. Of course. You know, you should pray. You can pray also that Krishna will send you people, and somehow or other you'll be able to introduce them. You can pray like that. And oftentimes people, you know, things will just... Krishna will just arrange things. It happens all the time. In fact, there's so many ways that it happens. Yeah. If we're looking for the opportunities, they'll be there. That's the point. If you're not looking, they may not be there. But if you're looking, then it'll be there. Okay. So we started a little late, and so we're ending 9 minutes late. I thank you for attending, and we'll see you same time next week. Hare Krishna.